KBOO Community Radio and Peña Flamenca de Portland are proud to co-sponsor Lily Last and Pepe Rafael on Friday, July 25th at 7:30 p.m. Pepe Rafael of Pepe and the Bottle Blondes will team up with Lily Last of Stomptown Flamenco for an evening of flamenco. Again, that's Lily Last and Pepe Rafael on Friday, July 25th at 7:30 p.m. at the Steep and Thorny Way to Heaven, located at Southeast 2nd Avenue and Madison Street in Portland. More information is available at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
Welcome to Between the Covers, a weekly KBOO program featuring interviews with authors of fiction and nonfiction. I'm your host this week, Leanne Kranz. I'm joined in the studio this morning by Portland-based author Polly Dugan, here to talk about her debut short story collection, So Much a Part of You, published last month by Little Brown and Company. 10 linked stories trace the family pathologies of generations of Irish Catholic characters from the Depression era to post 9/11 in New Jersey, New York City, and Portland, Oregon. At the heart of the collection is a triangle between the characters Anna, Peter, and Anne. Polly Dugan graduated from Dickinson College and is a four-time attendee of our local Tin House Writers Workshop. Her stories have been published in Line Zero and Narrative and received honorable mention in Glimmer Train's Short Story Award for New Writers. She is currently working on a novel, The Sweetheart Deal, due out this spring. Welcome, Polly Dugan.
Thank you, Leanne. It's really great to be here.
Congratulations on your first publication.
Thanks so much. It's been out a month as of today.
So for the listeners out there, can you give a general sense of what this collection is about?
Yeah, I think that you hit on some of the really high notes. Certainly there is a triangle at the center of this book. And the story Masquerades, that is the sixth story in the collection, is the first story that I wrote. And that's where the triangle is introduced. Anna and Peter and Anne all appear there together for the first time. And just because of some of the magic of how writing works, the other stories emanated from that first one, both forward and backward in time. And because I'm familiar with the Irish Catholic culture, I felt certainly informed and entitled to explore what these characters grapple with, which are not really unique circumstances. Certainly infidelity and abortion and death, losses of parents, friends, children are not particular to this group of people, but the lens through which I try to explore those particular issues and try to take them through their journey. I put them through an awful lot of mess. I really do. But in the end, they suffer, but they survive. And I think that their resiliences, each character's resiliences, are things that I've learned a lot from spending the time with them that I have.
Mm-hmm. I'm always curious in linked collections. You know, you begin with one story. Was there a particular character that really sparked you out of that triangle that fed everything else?
I think that, you know, I wrote the story, Masquerades, in 2006, and then the other stories over time between 2006 and 2010, late 2010, early 2011, that I've thought a lot about since the book was published, kind of tracing mm-hmm. my steps. And it's not an easy thing to think about since it happened over such a long period of time. But I will say, honestly, in answer to your question, I think that Peter Herring, really, of the three characters, was someone who was really intriguing to me because you know, he's got two women who are really fond of him at different points in the book. And I remember talking to my editor Judy Klein at Little Brown early on, and her saying, oh my gosh, the women of Little Brown just love Peter Herring.
Yeah, he's a good guy.
And I think one of the things that was so intriguing to me about him is that in that first story, he might seem somewhat one-dimensional and somewhat sort of easy to stereotype or maybe even judge. And that can be true, I think, of any of us meeting or seeing someone at first blush or, you know, in a limited experience or a limited arena or realm. But of course, that's not true about any of us. Mm-hmm. And so in the other stories, I thought about playing with his moral compass. And then that exercise allowed me to do the same thing with other people who seem really, really redeemable, certainly, or flawed, and people who we might be inclined to vilify have moments of redemption.
Yeah, it was really interesting to read the collection, and you know, you get a sense who the main players are, but then often the story that follows takes you in a completely surprising direction. Mm-hmm. There were certain characters that maybe tugged on, like fringe characters in one story would suddenly be at center stage in the next one. It was really fun to read and surprising. Mm. But there was this cohesion to all the stories. It was really, you know, it wasn't the experience of reading a novel where everything gets tied up at the end. But you get a full story. It was really deep and complex. You did a really nice job with that.
Oh, thank you so much. That's just great, great, generous praise and feedback to hear. And I think that, you know, early on, this might seem like it's not related, but for parents who are familiar with Peggy Rathman's books, Goodnight Gorilla, and then there's another one called 10 Minutes Till Bedtime. And I read Goodnight Gorilla to my sons as a board book. And then later, when they were older, 10 Minutes Till Bedtime has more of a story to it. And 10 Minutes Till Bedtime, in one of the scenes, the boy who's dragging his feet going to bed with 10 hamsters sharing that procrastination looks out the window and sees the animals escaping from the zoo in Goodnight Gorilla. And I thought it was such a clever, really wonderful sort of trick for the author to have linked those two stories that the reader, you know, it's kind of a wink and a nod that the reader can be privy to. And that happened, gosh, so far in advance of when I started writing, but I realized, well, I want to try that.
And that's how life is, if you really think about it. It got me really thinking in several ways. One thing that this collection does very clearly is it traces how the actions or the lives of characters in one generation have a direct impact on all the family members that come after, you know, and I found that really interesting. So I'm thinking in particular of John Riley. His childhood impacted what sort of father he turned out to be, and then impacted his daughter, one of the main characters, Anna. Also, Joan Cavanaugh, a character I loved.
Yeah, I love her, you know, too. She's great.
You know, that actually, she spoke to me. You know, she's a very vibrant, grand woman who has these daughters, and she's trying to impart what I would want to tell my daughters if I had them. You know, don't get married so early. Don't have kids so young. Go out and do and live and explore, and you can be anything. But that sort of benevolent advice ended up really impacting her daughter and Peter, the one man who loved her daughter. Do you want to talk about any of that generational?
Oh, sure. Sure. I think that, and I can only really speak from experience, but our families of origin and our parents specifically and our earliest friendships are the models by which we learn how the world works, you know, and I put works in quotation marks because it's really subjective. One family's truth is not necessarily their next door neighbor's truth. And in the case of John Riley, you know, his father Jack is a very menacing, oppressive figure in the first story in the collection, and he ends up, you know, not necessarily intentionally, but repeating the sins of the father. And then, of course, that is what Anna Riley's environment is that she's growing up in. And by the time she's an adult, she's able to have developed the perspective that she doesn't want to repeat necessarily those sins. You know, by the last story in the collection, she's in a very difficult spot, grieving and in a stage of adulthood, kind of being a middle-aged orphan. And conscious of, in the case of the Rileys, you know, the lure of alcoholism and wanting to not repeat those same lessons, but it's an effort to either choose or not choose the things that you've known your whole life. And just like in the case with Joan Kavanaugh, she, as you just said, imparts this sort of object lesson to her children, because she herself was a very young bride and mother. And part of part of the effect, I guess, on him in the story Legacies is what I think most of us have grown up with. Children can choose to reject what their parents issue or advise. And in the case of Anne Kavanaugh and Joan Kavanaugh, Anne is not rejecting that the way in the last story, mm-hmm. Anna Riley is trying to reject the lessons that she grew up with.
Yeah, it was, you know intuitively that families, you know, impact each other, but the way you really tell it, it's chilling, just to see the
Thanks.
Connection. And you root for you don't want them to fall into those patterns, and it's heartbreaking when they do, and mm-hmm. triumphant when they don't. And a lot of good stuff in there.
Oh, thanks so much.
You know, one of the things I have to just say, the experience of reading these stories, it seemed that you really teetered between darkness and light. Mm. I'll try to articulate this. You know, your characters can be engaging in what felt kind of like a nostalgic Americana sort of activities, like paper routes and building a homecoming float and college parties and first love and all that. But there was like this menacing undercurrent, or something really startling or tragic would happen. And I wondered, was that intentional? Do you enjoy work writing from that line?
Well, I think that in my work, I invariably return to what's really the unavoidable and complicated irony about life, is that sometimes our deepest, darkest times and losses and struggles occur against a backdrop or in tandem with life being really good, or certain aspects of our lives being really good. And I can speak from experience, and that showed up to inform my work, because when my older son was born in 2003, my mother was battling, and we didn't know it at the time, but ultimately losing her battle with cancer. And that was an incredibly joyful time in my family's life. And yet when my son was 8 months old, my mother passed away. And so it's such a tricky middle ground to navigate, because we don't get to, it would be so nice to order up when all of our tough stuff comes. You know, I'd like that, you know, every second Tuesday, but I mean, it would just, I don't know if it would make things easier or not, but the balance of those things happening adjacent to one another is just how life is. And so it's just something that I've continued to explore in my work, and maybe in part because I feel like I can have some control over the outcome if I'm making it up.
Yeah, that tension was really interesting. I like to reach for the book and get back into it. But there were some stories I had to read from like 10 paces.
Oh,
like
right.
Kitten Season, mm-hmm. for example. You don't shy away from difficult subjects. Not only do you cover them in your stories, but you really penetrate them. And I know that takes a lot of bravery. And
well, I have a dark side that I tend towards. I really do. And it's something that my really close friends know about me. And certainly more people will after our conversation and maybe picking up the book. But I also think, too, that the obsessions that I return to in my writing, I feel like, demand my attention. Mm. And it's maybe perhaps in some way kind of exposure therapy for me to explore these things and, you know, darkness and loss and death and learn something from it. You know, and certainly too, like I just said a minute ago, there's a certain amount of control writers can execute over their characters and their works that is comforting because we don't have control over things that happen in our lives or over people. You know, you can't ever make people do things the way you want them to, but as a writer, you can do that with your characters. So it's, I don't know if it's a choice or catharsis, but mm-hmm. it seems to work, and so I'm grateful it has a place to go.
It makes for a great story.
Thank you.
You're listening to Between the Covers on KBOO. Our guest today is Portland-based author Polly Dugan, here talking about her debut short story collection, So Much a Part of You. And she has agreed to read something for us today. Do you want to give us the setup?
I do. I'm going to read a portion of the story called Handfuls. And the story is about a couple, Palmer and Carolyn Kurtz, who have endured the really terrible loss of the deaths of their twin girls born prematurely. And the story covers sort of the aftermath of this terrible loss and their struggle to, in that aftermath, maintain their marriage, maintain their allegiance to each other, their love, to not have that also come undone. And so this is from the beginning of the story and just a little bit of glimpse of what they go through. On a stifling July day at the end of her second trimester, Palmer and Carolyn had taken refuge in a movie theater for a matinee when her contractions started. For no predictable reasons, the doctor said later, contractions that all the drugs couldn't stop. Then, when there was no turning back, although Carolyn had pushed and pushed, labored so hard, Palmer thought, the girls had slid out into the world as effortlessly as ice cubes thawing in the sun. Grace, born first, hung on for a week after their birth, and her sister Abigail a mere 52 hours longer, before the sparks of their lives fizzled out, their fledgling hearts and lungs lasting as long as they could, the available technology impotent. They never even opened their eyes. They were so small, Palmer could hold each of them in the center of his open hand. But before they had left the hospital, all four of them, Carolyn had cradled each daughter's body, swaddled for home but bound for the mortuary, against her own, and rocked in the glider. She had been dry-eyed while she hummed Itsy Bitsy Spider twice, but Palmer had not. When they switched places and he had rocked each of his lifeless daughters, she left the room, but he could hear her keening outside the door. Days later, sitting in their bed at home, calm and coherent on Xanax, Carolyn had said, "You know, Palm, maybe that was their destiny. What if I couldn't handle it? I might have had something postpartum and smothered them or thrown them off a bridge while you were at work. This way, at least, I'm not locked up." He'd had to take a walk alone and weep again until he was spent. Her crazy rationale, while medicated, shocked him. That she could think such a thing, let alone say it, was proof that she occupied a darkness of which she'd revealed just a glimpse. It was proof that he was in over his head much more than he knew. The only response he could muster was to leave the house. Selecting the caskets had furnished the most torture. They were cartoonishly tiny, conjuring for Palmer shoeboxes in which people buried a dead bird or baby bunny found in the yard. Yet such coffins were manufactured, so they couldn't be the only ones with a need. You shouldn't be able to pick up a coffin for a person with your own two hands. You needed to call on 8 strong men, or at least 6. That was true when his grandparents died. He wasn't sure he and Carolyn would make it through the task, but what had held them up had been the funeral director, Matt McKay, and his gentle comfort and sympathy, devoid of pity, as he helped them choose. He was a pro, to say the least, and his compassion shifted, but didn't relieve, Palmer's anguish. During the morning they spent with him, McKay had quietly shared the story of the loss of his and his wife's second child, a girl, to SIDS decades earlier. His mortuary had buried her. Now their four grown children were in their 20s and 30s, the two eldest working in the funeral business alongside their father. During their appointment, Carolyn, without provocation, defended their choice for burial. "I know they were barely here, and so small they barely were, but I can't imagine burning them up," she said. "In our family, when someone dies, we bury them. We go and visit." When she was 19, Carolyn had lost her mother, Joan, to breast cancer. Palmer had never known Joan, only her legend, but he had visited her grave every time he and Carolyn had traveled to New York. She didn't even have her mother to nurture and console her. In Joan's absence, her three daughters mothered each other. Nonetheless, Palmer was infuriated that she had uttered such a macabre thing about their daughters' bodies. "Her insanity has no bottom," he thought, "and she's taking us deeper and deeper. I'm just as off my nut," he condemned himself, "that I'm going down with her." But McKay, unfazed, had put his arm around her shoulder while the tears rolled down her face. "You're doing the hardest thing a parent ever has to, Carolyn. Those visits will be important, and when you make them, you will remember how brave you were today." Carolyn composed herself enough to say, through trembling lips, "We don't need to. Put them in the same one, so they'll be together, like they were before. That's all they know."
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. You're welcome.
That is Portland-based author Polly Dugan reading from her brand new short story collection, So Much a Part of You, from the story Handfuls. Ooh, that was very powerful. That's just an example of your ability to, you know, dwell in the darkness but make it poignant and beautiful.
Yeah, that was a particularly emotional passage to write, actually. I was thinking about that when I knew that was going to be the selection that I was going to be reading today. And I think that certainly once you're a parent and you have children, that is really, for me, the worst thing that I can think of. And because my children survived their newborn and infancy times of their lives, it was something that I felt like I could return to safely and cover, because certainly for a lot of people that has been something that they've gone through, and this couple is an example of that.
In this story, I was very interested in how much sort of time you gave to the husband. Mm-hmm. You know, you really, throughout the book, one thing that I feel is unique is that you kind of give the man's side of the story when it comes to pregnancies gone wrong or terminated early, et cetera. Mm-hmm. You give the husband in this scene, you know, his inner thoughts are really prevalent. And also Peter in the story, he finds, I don't want to give too much away, but he was in a relationship that the pregnancy didn't come to fruition. That's mm-hmm. all I'll say. And he was very impacted by that. Mm-hmm. And it was interesting to get that side of the story. You don't often hear that.
I think that in the story Paying the Piper, which is the initial story that sets what you're alluding to in motion, neither of us want to provide any spoilers while still providing some intrigue and interest. But it was something that I thought about, because just based on what a hot topic abortion is in this country, the politics, pro-choice, pro-life, Roe versus Wade in the Supreme Court, and again, the Catholic culture mm-hmm. that these people live in, I thought it would be intriguing to explore the man's perspective, and also if he's not included in, you know, ultimately when that situation happens.
Mm-hmm. Very interesting. You have a new novel coming out in the spring. And I understand two characters from this collection show up in this novel. Can you talk at all in general terms about the new novel and how these folks might pop up?
Oh, yeah. I'm really thrilled to. The novel's called The Sweetheart Deal, and it's going to be published spring, projected June 2015, so about a year after the story collection. About a year after that, that one's birthday. And the book is about a confirmed bachelor serial monogamist who, 12 years after a drunken Y2K promise with his best friend, is forced to honor the promise to marry his best friend's wife if he dies. And thus the title. But the wife in the book is a woman named Audrey McGeary, who's a character I really love, and she's magnificent and tough, and is someone that I would.
Audrey from this collection.
Yes,
liked her.
Yeah, okay. I liked her too. So it's Audrey from the story Black Ball in the collection, and then the other character that resurfaces in The Sweetheart Deal is Kevin Gallagher, who is the firefighter in the final story of the collection, Collateral. And he was such a wonderful, tortured, conflicted character to spend time with that, as we sort of mentioned earlier, I'm drawn towards those kinds of complicated people. And so he is a very predominant character in the novel. He is the best friend of my dead hero, Leo McGeary. And he's the book couldn't exist without him. So, and Matt McKay, the funeral director, is also in there again too. He was a great character, and he does his magnificent, gracious job again when he's relied on by this family. So I'm excited. I'm really, really thrilled about that. The book's actually probably going to be going into production soon. We're going through final edits, and it's great. Now I'm trying to work on the third one.
Oh, good. Can't wait for that. You know, I wanted to mention the Tin House Writers Workshop is coming up.
Next week?
Yeah, starts Sunday. And I want to mention to the listeners that even if you're not attending that local writers workshop, there are several events that are happening throughout the week that are open to the public. Some do have a fee, but do check the Tin House website for events, lectures, readings, signings, etc. You credit this writing workshop as really helping your writing. Anything you want to say to those listening about what you got from it?
I don't have an MFA, and living in Portland, it's always been incredibly convenient for me to attend. 2010 through 2013 inclusive, and it's really where I got my education as a writer. I had just such incredible, well, every attendee does, incredible access to incredible writers. You're sitting down the first day, it's sort of immediately trust and speed dating, and you're also there with amazing peers. And it's kind of the golden rule, you know, treat others as you want to be treated, and the work just gets such thorough attention. And by the end of the week, you've become part of this larger writing community, and friends that I made, you know, in 2010, I'm still in touch with. So I just think it's a great, great program, and I'll be popping down there next week to take advantage of it and see some friends that are in town.
Thank you, Polly Dugan, and congratulations on the publication of your new collection, So Much a Part of You. Thank you for being our guest.
Thank you, Leanne. It's been such a pleasure to be here.
And I would like to thank Carrie Neal at Little Brown & Company for all of her help with coordination. And thank you all for listening to Between the Covers. I'm Leanne Kranz. Stay tuned for Words and Pictures.
Thursdays from 6 to 7 p.m. to hear Rose City Native Radio with your host, Jackie Malmstrom. Rose City Native Radio is a new public affairs program bringing you local and national Native issues and Native contemporary music. You can find more information about the show online at kboo.fm or find us on Facebook at Rose City Native Radio.
KBOO wants you. Yes, you. Are you excited about the new possibilities for local independent media? Are you ready to help KBOO reach out and grow stronger in the community? We're looking for candidates for KBOO's board of directors, and we've extended our search through July 31st. So if you'd like to share your skills with the people who share your values, download a copy of our board candidate package at kboo.fm. Or you can pick up a copy at the station during business hours. We're located at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. Applications must be received by 5 p.m. July 31st, so don't delay. And we look forward to seeing more of you at KBOO.
Welcome to Words and Pictures, the comics and animation show. I'm your host, S.W. Conser, and today we are going to bring summer school to you. In a few minutes, we'll be joined by stand-up economist Yoram Bauman. He's just co-authored a book along with Grady Klein. It's called The Cartoon Guide to Climate Change. But first, we'd like to welcome back to the show Gus Frederick, Oregon's comics historian. Earlier this week, I took a field trip with Gus to find out more about some upcoming events he's helping put together. So if our engineer Rock has that audio ready, let's roll it. Take it away. So yeah, I'm out here in Cedar Hills, west of Portland, with Gus Frederick. We're at the Mount Calvary Cemetery. And Gus, one of the projects that you've been involved in is making sure that Homer Davenport's name is better known to Oregonians, because cartoon historians will recognize the name Thomas Nast, but Homer was a hometown boy